You know, even though this scenario is a pretty specific situation, an airport that many pilots will never go to, and in a particular airplane, I think one of the bigger picture items here is this whole idea of planning and changing the plan. And I want to go to you, JP. You talked about your real world experience in the Mooney. You rotated maybe a little early and stall warning horn right away. 12,000 feet of runway. Yeah, that gave you lots of room to complete a takeoff run, but it also would have been lots of room to abort. And yet you kept going. So true confessions, did you keep going because, hey, there was 12,000 feet of runway, I know I've got plenty of room to get airborne? Or did you keep going because it's really, really hard to abort a takeoff that far into the takeoff? We're mission-minded, and the first thing you want to do is figure out how to get the plane into the air.
Yeah, great question, Jeff. And the answer on that particular day, I operate out of Birmingham. We have two runways. We have a 12,000-foot runway, and we have a 7,000-foot runway. And reflecting back to that day, the 12,000-foot runway, it's a longer taxi. It makes it a little bit more inconvenient. But I knew I was right there close to max gross, and I wanted to have options in case there was a reason to abort. I didn't necessarily think that I would be running into this particular reason to abort, but I knew the 12,000-foot runway would give me options, and there were no obstacles at the end of that runway. So to answer your question, I continued because I knew I could continue accelerating and give this a shot and see if this works. If it doesn't, I can set it back down because I had plenty of room to stop.
Let me stay with you, JP. Again, true confessions. Have you ever had a situation where you've had to abort a takeoff after VR, essentially where you've begun to rotate and then decided that far into it, this isn't going to work? Ever happened?
A number of aborted takeoffs, never at that phase of the flight. So that was kind of in a critical area. The airport that I used to operate out of was a 5,000-foot runway. And I would have said with good confidence, if that would have happened at that airport, I would have just said, okay, we're coming back down, stopping, and not going to attempt this.
Yeah, because that's definitely a rare kind of thing. I can say the only time I've ever had a situation like that where I aborted at VR was a Cirrus when I saw a fox run across just as the nose came up. And I didn't know whether I caught it with the prop or not. And it took huge force of will to abort the takeoff, and there was plenty of runway in that case. So the other option five people, Catherine, Tom, John, David, have any of you ever had to abort a takeoff after the nose has come up? Tom?
Well, after the tail has come up, yes, in my Cessna 120 many, many years ago. I had what turned out to have been a crack in the cylinder that was causing to produce less power than expected. At that point, I was trying, admittedly, very early in my piloting career, trying to will the aircraft into the air, and actually did, and decided this is not a good idea, and put it back down on the available runway. But that was very long ago, and it was a very obvious power development issue. But at least in my situation, I have done that one time in about 5,000 hours of flying experience.
A friend of mine bought a Cessna 421, and I was teaching him how to fly it. And we just started to rotate when one of the engines burped. And I just sawed both throttles to idle. And we used every inch of the runway to get stopped. It, maybe a bit more interesting one was just not that long ago, I was in a glider. And the tow plane had a reduced power, but kept going. And so I'm chugging along behind the tow plane, which is still on the ground, well past when it should have been. And I'm debating what to do. And then the airplane lifted off and flew on a shallow climb. And so the takeaway was I knew something was wrong. I should have released and just landed on the runway ahead. So I guess I have a foot at both camps. I rejected, which was a good call on that because it turned out there was an engine issue. But in the other one, when it was obvious that things weren't working out, I just hung in there.
And I think that's a really important part of this scenario is it's easy to say five, to choose five in this sort of cold light of day here. But in the moment where the airplane is light on the wheels, the runway is running out, you're almost there, almost airborne, it's really difficult to give up that far in. I'm not sure if I was this pilot, I could do it. And this is sort of based in a real world back when I was a student pilot with an instructor. And we went into Leadville and ended up doing a touch and go. And I'll tell you, it took a lot of runway for us to get back in the air. By the time we finally did, I'm not sure we could have stopped. But we did, and we circled up and we went on. I don't know that I would do that today. But Wally, I appreciate that you have chosen option three. And so I want to know what you're thinking on that. How much is it where you are in the process, the difficulty of the abort, the calculus of doing it? How do you come to that conclusion?
Well, I kind of feel like the chicken stands alone here in the group today. But
Well, I'm with you, Wally, I think is what I'm saying. Okay. But go on, because we did it, worked out.
Well, my history has seen just a lot of bad results from aborted takeoffs and people changing plans in the middle of a takeoff. So I'm sort of more inclined to the go decision. But the thing that really pushed me over the edge on this, and I don't know whether our scenario pilot did this in part of his pre-flight planning, but if you look at Google Earth, you can see that there's a nice overrun past the end of the runway, which sort of goes with JP's suggestion. It might not be terrible to stop in that overrun either. However, the terrain actually descends from the airport, and you can go out that valley for a long way, so it's not necessary to climb. You've got plenty of time to get the gear up and get the airplane accelerated to an appropriate climb speed. And then, as we looked at the charts, the climb charts, the airplane actually should climb pretty well once it gets up to speed. So, to me, if I had done the pre-flight planning that should have been done, and I knew that there were no obstacles off the end of that runway, and, you know, I only need 5 more miles an hour to get to normal rotation speed. I've got 1,700 feet there. So I'm just more inclined to go for it. I think there's another thing to this scenario. The pilot did a lot of pre-flight planning and looking at distances and even trying to interpolate what happens when you get off the chart. And he knew there was quite a lot of risk there. Now he arrives at the airport. He wants to plan and land to get his certificate. Now he arrives at the airport and he says, well, conditions are a little worse than I planned for, but here's an idea. Let's try a touch and go. You know, so now he's kind of making up the thing as it goes along. And I think the better decision would have been to return to wherever he departed from and wait for a better day.
You know, that, Wally, I think is part of the crux of the scenario, and I want to make sure we come back to that. But JP, you had something to add here.
Yeah, and Jeff, you know this. In full disclosure, this was one of the things that I toyed with. Five is you can abort, and you kind of know what you have there. You end up hoping to stop on the remaining part of the runway. But also looking at this airport, on a Google Maps, you can see there's really no obstacles directly ahead. There is an overrun there. So I kind of got caught up in the heat of the moment thinking, well, you know, the numbers say this airplane can do this, and there's nothing that's going to be an obstruction at the end of the runway, even if I have a really, really abysmal climb. So I was going back and forth and thinking, you know, if I was really here, would I really abort? That is the psychological aspect of this. And if you're flying bigger airplanes, we're taught in the jets, we're not aborting after VR. We just don't do that. So this is a real psychological thing that you're going to have to get yourself into if you're actually going to choose option five. It's a pretty easy choice when you're reading out loud here, but in the heat of the moment, I think that's what we battle with.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the performance and the planning here. Catherine, before this scenario, we were chatting a little bit about your surprise that a 250 Comanche would have a service ceiling above 20,000 feet thereabout. And I said, yeah, the engineers are probably really surprised about that too, but the marketing department is right behind it. So in your opinion, just sort of mathematically, Was this whole plan flawed looking at these charts?
Yeah, I have to say when I consider the resources for this, I did a double, triple take on the climb rate chart that showed an absolute ceiling at max gross of 22,000 feet. This is a 250 horsepower engine. And I'm calling BS when I'm looking at this chart. You know, in our mathematics and statistics courses, we talk about the danger of extrapolating, and there's a good reason for that. There are a lot of quantities. You know, anytime you see a graph in a POH, it's telling the relationship between two quantities. And a lot of times that the way those quantities vary is linearly. And that happens until a certain point. But generally speaking, that relation isn't linear. So a lot of the lines that you see in your POH look linear, but if you go beyond them, they're not. For example, I grabbed the POH for my own Bonanza, and I found that, you know, this pilot uses this computer and roughly finds a correction of about 100%. It's going to take about 100% longer to take off at 10,000 as it would at sea level. My Bonanza POH, which does actually go to 10,000 feet, showed almost a 230%. So you're adding basically 130%, not 100% to that distance. So, you know, you should really be careful when you think about extrapolating.
That totally makes sense to me. But, you know, in that case, does that mean you can never take off from Leadville in a PA-24? Because the engineers putting this together, they didn't give you that information. So is every airport above 8,000 feet pressure altitude off limits because, the POH doesn't have the numbers? Or what's a pilot to do?
Yeah, so let me jump back in about that as well. And this is something that we should all do with our POHs. As an examiner, and I think Wally might agree to this, you know, we have people do these takeoff calculations as part of the practical exam, but very rarely do I see, when I say ask for that short field takeoff, very rarely do I see anybody connecting what the calculation said. So for example, I might have a candidate that says, okay, I expect to be off the ground in 800 feet for this short field effort. Mm-hmm. And we get out to the runway and we're still on the ground 1,200 feet, 1,300 feet down the runway. And, you know, my alarm bells are going off. So, but the person doesn't seem to notice. We seem to divorce those exercises, the calculations with the actual practical experience. And that's something that I do a lot. You know, I love performance charts. So I'm very in tune to whether my performance charts are representing my airplane lately. And, you know, certainly it's a function of pilot technique, but truly it's a function of mostly, is that engine really producing the kind of power that it did when those performance charts were made? Years ago, I've had the joy of having two engines overhauled. And when I got one of them back, the climb rate that I got was over twice what it was before I sent that engine off to overhaul. So, you know, let that sink in. Yet that same performance chart is supposed to represent both airplanes, you know, the brand new one and the one with the really, really tired engine. So if I owned this plane, would I take off from Leadville? Possibly. But I'll tell you what I would do. I would be very in tune to how well my POH is, first of all, representing the airplane. So I would be able to, in a more informed way, make those extrapolations.
Yeah, and in defense of our pilot here, I think our pilot actually did some of those things, calibrating with different airports and adding the 50% margin in there. But it still begs the question, I appreciate your pointing it out, that these relationships, you know, they work until they don't. And especially given our aging fleet, we're getting to the point after repairs and engines and bent airframes and re-riggings for the 17th time, pretty much every airplane is practically a different airplane. Tom, you had something you wanted to add.
Well, going a little bit deeper into the takeoff performance charts, the calculations, the pilot in this scenario did in fact do quite a bit of homework ahead of time. Things worked out differently and didn't do the homework again, as Wally mentioned. But assuming that everything was working out the way it was supposed to in the first place, the pilot was making decisions based on ground roll information, where I think really maybe the pilot should have been thinking more about obstacle clearance distances. And again, like Catherine, my relevant experience here is not in the Comanche, but is in beach airplanes. But as a rule of thumb, if you do the calculations in the beach airplanes, the 50-foot obstacle clearance distance is usually about twice the ground roll distance. It's a real close approximation in most of the Bonanzas and Barons that I fly. So the pilot could expect to be at crossing a 50-foot obstacle in the case as originally planned, basically at or past the departure end of the runway. And think about the psychological impact of 50-foot obstacle. First, this requires a VX climb-out attitude, so it's going to be very marginal at Leadville. But second, that's only a little more than one wingspan above the ground in most general aviation airplanes. So we're a situation where the end of the runway is going to disappear behind the pilot, and the aircraft isn't even two wingspans above ground level at this point. Is the pilot going to have the discipline to maintain precise angle of attack and airspeed control, or is there going to be a psychological tendency you want to pull up? One last thing about possible aircraft performance is that in this scenario, the pilot tried to establish the takeoff attitude about 5 miles an hour below speed. Well, if you do that at less than the recommended liftoff speed, the airplane remains on the ground. The higher angle of attack and therefore higher drag created is probably going to cause the airplane to begin to decelerate. So the option of trying to continue until reaching the appropriate speed is going to take even all that much longer, because you're going to have to try to accelerate to that 65 miles an hour, I think it was, from a slower airspeed.
Let's go to John, then it'll be Catherine, then it'll be Wally. John.
So one of the things that we always talk about on any operation is, especially for takeoff, is a takeoff brief. You know, you're supposed to sit at the end of the runway and say, okay, this is what I'm going to do in this situation. And I think that was lacking here, even though it was either a touch and go or, you know, a landing. He should have been looking at what my approach is like. He said he did a short field approach. I assume that was because he wanted to be as slow as possible for touchdown and rollout purposes. But what's the technique and what's the markers for the touch and go? Looking at taxiways or runway signs or something, what's my go, no-go point? And how am I going to actually execute this touch and go? I'm not a big fan of touch and goes in complex airplanes anyhow, but what flap setting are you going to use? And more importantly, how are you going to set the mixture on the roll here? You know, it pushed it in a little bit. If you're taking off from a high altitude airport, the classic way of doing it is, you know, the full power run up, you set the mixture for maximum power. Rolling down the runway, you're not going to have time to look at that engine monitor and set it by fuel flow or anything like that. So I think the touch and go was more of a desperate kind of maneuver rather than pre-planned. And it sounds like 1,700 feet would have been sufficient to stop. So pre-briefing the whole thing in advance, I think, would have shown the red flags in this operation also.
So if I can sum that up before going over to Catherine, essentially what you're saying is by combining the landing and the takeoff, the touch and go, you robbed focus and time from each one. The pilot couldn't focus on the landing and do a landing really appropriate for the conditions, and then stop completely, and then focus and brief entirely on the takeoff, have the engine set correctly, abort points, and all that. By scrunching them all together to try and make it all work, the pilot actually undermined both activities, I think that is.
You said that so much more succinctly than I could have.
Catherine.
All right. At the risk of a little more Monday morning quarterbacking, I want to highlight a couple things suggested by Tom and John. So what I'd be really curious to find out is exactly where that touch took place. And Wally, I'd love to hear your take on this. As an examiner, I've probably given about 1,000 check rides at this point. And there are only two of those check rides where I've had to tell somebody, you are coming in too slowly. All of the other corrections or the suggestions that I've made, of which there are many, many, go like this. You are coming in too fast. You have too much energy when you are landing. So, you know, this is an unfamiliar airport. This is a bucket list item, right? Leadville is a bucket list item for lots and lots of people. So what I see people doing is when they get nervous, they're unfamiliar with, you know, an airport, adding 5 knots sounds like a good idea. Well, 10 knots must be better. So I would just be really curious to find out where that touch took place. And so, you know, a full stop would have just been so much smarter, you know, taxi back, regroup. And then as Tom suggested, you know, now you can actually make sense of your performance charts, you know, given the performance for takeoff.
Wally.
Well, I certainly agree with Catherine. The majority of the approaches are almost 100% too fast, almost never too slow. And I just wanted to reiterate and support what Tom Turner said about pulling the airplane off into ground effect, as in choice two. And I have a Comanche manual in front of me, and it's even supported by the manual. It says, trying to pull the aircraft off before the proper speed is obtained will only prolong the takeoff run, which is not something we need to do right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up from the manual, Wally.
I'd like one of those Super Comanches. Like, man, that's great performance. but yeah, I think the charts are like almost laughable. I'm not a fan of those little computers. I think, as alluded to by Catherine, we're having estimates on top of estimates with, you know, some magic guesses in there. And frankly, this guy, he might as well have taken the magic eight ball to figure out what was going on. I think one thing that hasn't been brought up, but is really important, is the Comanche is probably the worst possible airplane for this scenario. It's got a laminar flow wing, so it has the drag bucket. It sits quite nose high if it has a stock gear. And so you accelerate with a fairly significant angle of attack all through the roll. And you basically don't rotate in this scenario, I think. The airplane's going to fly off in almost a three-point attitude because it's already nose up. And so you're really setting yourself up for the low-speed liftoff and then hanging up in the drag bucket and going off the end of the runway. So I think the decision-making, you know, as everyone alluded to, was flawed. But I think the real problem here is the pilot hadn't intellectualized or hadn't thought through what the airplane was going to feel like. And that's why I think he saw, which I think is a very realistic scenario, the runway's starting to run out and the temptation is to ease back on the yoke, which is the worst possible thing to do in this airplane. So I don't personally think that this would have been a successful go. I think the more likely outcome would have been liftoff, ground effect, the airplane starts to sink, he unconsciously pulls back a bit more. We now have the high induced drag, high AOA scenario, and he goes off the end of the runway in the stall buffet or with the stall horn going, never gets to accelerate, and then flops into the valley. And this exact accident scenario happened to an airplane at the flying club that I belong to. And even though there was descending ground, they just froze on the yoke and the airplane settled in. So, and I also think that the airplane could have been stopped. But we go back to, I think the real takeaway to my view is, this is not a good idea. And it started out as not a good idea because it was too hot for them to even be there. And then it really turned into a not good idea when we converted the full stop into the go around. So like many of these scenarios, the pre-flight planning part was not fully completed or wasn't effective. And then that resulted in a whole bunch of choices, none of which were very good.
I definitely think that there's a lot that could be said, again, Monday morning quarterbacking on pre-flight planning. I will make a slight defense for the takeoff computer in this case. I learned about those from an NTSB investigator, and this was in Washington State. He would say, these things are great. They tell me exactly where the airplane has crashed, because he would actually take them to the site, plug in the calculations and measure it out. And like, sure enough, this is where they didn't get off the ground or where they fell. But they do any kind of a situation like that really definitely has to be done with a great deal of caution to understand and know how it's calibrated to your airplane, your safety margin, and your ability, plus the conditions. John.
So just two data points to throw into this. One, we were talking about the touchdown, and in the intro, it does say that you touched down at 1,000 feet. So you've now sacrificed, 20% of the runway, something like that, for no reason. There's no displaced threshold there or anything, which gives you then 5,400 feet, basically, for takeoff. The other data point to consider, this was like 10:30 in the morning. It's only going to get hotter as the day goes on. And even if you do the abort and taxi back, it's just going to get worse and worse, which is all part of this pre-planning thing that fell through the cracks.
Yeah, absolutely. And David, your point was well taken that we picked the worst possible airplane for this, not by accident. Sounds like a great idea from the outside, but I totally agree, that big nose wheel. And that's why the pilot didn't touch down on the end of the runway, because was afraid of striking the nose gear and porpoising another Comanche, because it definitely happens. Tom.
Well, first, in the pilot's defense, the performance data show that should be a great airplane to be able to do that. I was thinking, and part of what John was talking about here was what I wanted to bring up next, is that the pilot had a goal. The pilot wanted to get that certificate. What might the pilot have done differently that would have made it more likely to be able to achieve that goal? And one of the things is, as John said, use the available runway, given a good review of obstacle clearance requirements, and not aim all of the way down the runway as he did. If that was, in fact, the original aim spot, then perhaps even beyond that. Another thing would have been to time it as, again, John said, to a day or time of day when the temperature was lower. One of the things that was in the setup to the scenario is that the airplane was at about 80% of maximum gross weight. Well, you probably could have gotten it down even lower than that, significantly lower than that, if the goal is to get that certificate. And finally, we have a goal. Now the pilot en route determines that he can no longer attain that goal on this flight. In this case, hey, it's not important to go there, except that's what we want to do. We're going to have to go back someday and get that certificate anyhow, and then maybe have it with an asterisk. Well, it's your first full stop landing at Leadville. It's not your first landing at Leadville. There are several things that the pilot could have done that might have made it easier to attain what he considered to be the goal of this flight. And when that goal was no longer available, well, don't try to make it up as you go. Options 1 through 4, in my opinion, all are one form or another of the hero culture that sometimes we have in aviation. I can make it work. I've seen all these World War II movies. I've read Fate is the Hunter. I've done all this stuff. I'm a good pilot. I can do this as well. I do want to ask Wally something very quickly here. Wally said, not to pick on you, but you're the dissenter here. Wally said that he elected not to abort because he had seen so many bad outcomes from aborted takeoffs. Maybe one that's a lack of practice on them. But I'll ask, what are the outcomes you have seen? Probably just airplane damage. And what are the outcomes that you might see had the pilot attempted to continue but not had the performance? What sort of outcomes were you thinking of when you said you've seen bad outcomes from aborted takeoffs?
My experience, Tom, is in that area is primarily in the airline area. And as someone else mentioned here earlier, JP mentioned it, that in the airlines, it's pretty cut and dried when you do and do not abort. Mm-hmm. But I investigated an accident where the pilot aborted well after rotation, even though conditions told him not to do that. The airplane burned. Fortunately, 240 people evacuated from that airplane without any major injuries, sprained ankles. But in the airline world, there's been a number of aborts at high speeds, whether they were above or below the V1, the decision speed, near it, that just did not turn out well. And I realize a Comanche abort is a little different deal. I certainly can't disagree with JP's decision on this scenario, because he's got the overrun out there that's going to be soft, and chances are the results are going to be fine at that abort. Well, I don't think it'll stop on the runway, but the people aren't going to get hurt. So it's just my experience. I'm in the go mode.
I want to talk just a little bit before we finish up about that whole idea of the abort and what you would have to do. We are at a much higher true airspeed here, meaning in this case, we've got at 65 miles an hour, we're certainly going faster than that. There is a good chance that we're going to go off the end of the runway if we keep going straight ahead. I could see people slowing down and realizing, hey, I think I can make that turn off at the end because I'm still going. I'm seeing shaking of heads in a couple places here. If you know you're going to go off the runway at low speed, do you take it straight off the runway and into the lights and the grass and whatever's out there? Or do you try and make that turn or ground loop at the end, which will hopefully, you know, shed some speed? Tom, you were just like shaking your head. No. You don't try and spin off the end of the runway there. Just take it straight ahead. I'll let you take that one.
I remember in the T-41A and U.S. Air Force pilot screening where I first soloed, I remember that being one of the memory checklist items, ground loop as required at the end of the abort. And the idea was let's keep it where the rescue people can see the mangled, burning wreck of what happens if I try to do that in an aborted takeoff. I think the structure of the aircraft is there to protect you as long as you keep going in the normal direction of flight. And you might even consider I'd consider retracting the landing gear before I would consider trying to make a sharp turn at a relatively high speed.
No, but
history shows that if you go essentially straight ahead, and assuming you're wearing shoulder harnesses, you will have a good outcome if you just keep it under control in a straight line.
I have seen doing mountain instruction with people in the past, they do see the end of the runway coming up. They lift off early. And a lot of times what happens is they get into ground effect above the runway and the plane stops climbing. And the only thing to do there is to actually put the nose down and build speed, aiming right for your obstacle before climbing over it, and you will make it, or you won't, and you're going to fly right into the trees. David, you were nodding.
Yeah, I think the first step is to just retard the throttle and land straight ahead if you can do it. But yes, I have the same thing. With students, I deliberately do a very low power takeoff to simulate a very high density altitude and get them in that exact situation. But I think one final comment I'd like to make, going back to what Wally said. So my last large airplane I flew was a Lockheed Electra. And we sat on the ground because the temperature was 2 degrees warmer than the hottest temperature in the AFM. And so we didn't have performance data. Right? In commercial aviation, no data means no go. And I think that's worth saying, you know, mm-hmm. If you don't have data, the safest thing to do is say, nope, I'm not going there. This is black and white in commercial aviation. We have the flexibility in private or recreational aviation to interpolate, but you can never go wrong if you stick with the actual demonstrated data out of the limitations and performance sections of a POH.
Plus, if you're going to add a safety buffer for age and variation and the aircraft itself, this conversation has been great. We didn't even get into what having the camera in the cabin was doing for this situation, so we'll save that for another time. But certainly one of the things I think of looking at this, people who know me know that I just like the whole saying to plan the flight and fly the plan, because you plan the flight and then you fly the flight. You got to be ready to accommodate the unexpected. But this scenario really highlights the caveat on that, which is when something must go as planned to work, you don't change the plan on the fly. You either do it as planned, or if the situation doesn't let you, you abort the mission until you can make a new plan without all that completion pressure.